This is a Sound Rebel podcast.
Discover more of our shows at soundrebel.co.uk.
Hi, welcome to the Keep Real podcast, the show that explores real stories from real people with a focus on mental health. I'm Kim, and on the last episode of the series, we have the wonderful integrative psychotherapist, Irini Hadjianu. We chat about her experiences as a therapist, her tips and advice in lockdown, and why mental health support is changing for the better. Irini, tell me a little bit about yourself, because I know we've had chats off the pod about therapy, about our experiences. So for everyone that doesn't know what you do, just tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, pleasure. So my name is Irini Hadjianu. I'm an integrative psychotherapist, and those are quite fancy words that basically mean I offer talking therapy. The integrative bit means that I integrate a few different theories together to work with my clients. So I basically have a core theoretical model, but there's flexibility within that, which is really helpful because obviously everybody's different. And I've been doing this job since 2010. So it's definitely evolved over time in terms of how I think about each person that I work with, how I think about mental health generally. And also being like a queer affirmative therapist means that I'm constantly queering the theory, which basically means that you just sort of really acknowledge that a lot of the core theories that we're taught as practitioners are based in kind of patriarchal, very cisgender, heteronormative, you know, all those fun things, structures. It's interesting when you're using Freud to apply it to an LGBT perspective. That's kind of me in a nutshell.
Yeah, that's amazing though. I think it's really vital, because I know that we've like pinpointed that before in previous conversations about knowing the limits of what is out there, like theoretically, and how it's adapted to the now. So what do you think's happened in the last 10 years being a therapist? That's quite a big loaded question.
Oh, to be honest, it's making me think about kind of just the mental health field in general and not just the theoretical side of it. Yeah. Because like I say, a lot of the core theories that we're taught as practitioners are very much, you know, from, I guess, the early 1900s, mid 1900s. And, you know, It's really helpful if you're looking to research to evolve your practice. So I specialize in working with trauma, specifically with survivors of sexual violence. So a lot of that has involved picking up on research on how the body's impacted by trauma, for example. So I would say that's one way that we can add sort of a neurobiological understanding of, you know, what happens for us in terms of our mental health, and how might that look if we're going to see a therapist. But in terms of, I guess, how the mental health field has sort of evolved, that's as broad as your question, really.
That is such a broad question.
It really is. Yeah.
It is. I'm the same. I don't know how to answer that either.
Is that why you asked me?
It's changed. Yeah, I thought, oh, let's test her. But even in the last few years of me, I did my degree, 5 or 6 years ago now in counselling, and I think that so much has changed within that time anyway, because, well, therapy's changed, I think. There's a lot more out there, and I still feel like not enough people know what kind of therapies are out there.
I would agree. And I think in some ways that's a bit of a blessing and a curse, because it means that people can actually find a therapist that they really kind of like resonate with, in terms of not even just the theories that they use, but I think like a worldview or an approach. And I'm very aware of that every time I meet someone new and I explain to them how I work. You know, you can tell straight away, and luckily people are very honest if what I'm saying sounds kind of good to them or not. But equally, it's very confusing. So when I've done podcasts before or just generally spoken to people, you know, I'm very aware that if somebody's looking for help, even just kind of the choice available is actually a bit of a barrier sometimes at worst. People just don't really know what's right for them. And it's such a vital thing when somebody is ready to access support that you sort of don't want to get it wrong, really.
Of course, yeah. And I think if you are going for support, you just kind of see the mental health counselling umbrella and think, oh, I just need a therapist. But actually, there's a lot more that goes on in there. Yeah. So what do you think people's current perceptions are of therapy?
And
what's available?
Yeah. I Yeah, it's interesting because I had to have therapy as part of my training. I did keep up with it afterwards. It is part of kind of practicing what I preach and looking after myself. I'm not having therapy at the moment, but to be honest, I think it'd be pretty weird if, as a psychotherapist, I'd never done it myself.
I don't think a lot of people know that in general, that therapists have to, it's part of the actual training to have therapy while you study and practice counselling.
Well, it's actually the hallmark of a good course, I would argue, because you have to know yourself very, very, very well to do this kind of job. And especially if you work in a relational way, which is how I work. You basically have to know what's your stuff and what's your client's stuff enough that you can manage sometimes even the impact of what you're hearing, because we all react to things differently, but then also just making sure you're staying very focused on your client and their needs rather than getting yours mixed up in, you know, your interventions and completely missing them. That's obviously not ideal. But yeah, going back to your original question, I think there is something about knowing what it's like to navigate the mental health system, and it is a biggie. And to be honest, the main thing that people want is to have a private space to talk to somebody. And there is actually a lot of research that shows that the biggest indicator of kind of therapeutic efficacy, like how successful is therapy, is the relationship between the therapist and the client. And that's very much characterized by the person's experience of their therapist rather than necessarily what interventions they're making. And I can definitely say that in terms of the feedback that I get, it's very rarely a client will say, you know, you gave me this theoretical interpretation and that kind of blew my mind. It's more, you know, I really appreciated what you're like to work with, or, you know, you giving me the space or not being judgmental. So I think that is definitely at the heart of what people are really looking for when they're asking for psychotherapy or counselling.
Yeah, and I think as well, like, not only some of those barriers are quite clear for a lot of people, like trying to go for therapy, but sometimes it can be quite difficult to even make that step of like, oh, I think I need to talk to somebody. And when you say that, sometimes it can be, oh, I just need to ring a helpline and go that route. Do you think that therapy is quite a clear, straightforward route for people? Do you think it should be improved?
I think accessibility is a massive issue. And that kind of goes back to what I was saying a bit earlier about how, you know, even as a profession, we're very predominantly white. We're very predominantly kind of cisgender. It's not to say that there's no diversity, because there definitely is. But I think we can do better. And that's a barrier in itself, not only to kind of really fully understanding through lived experience what our clients might have struggled with, but also just where we're placed in communities. And also a lot of the concepts or the language that we use are very sort of like ethnocentric. Like, they can be very white Western sort of ways of thinking about things. And I mean, I know from work that I've done with quite diverse groups of people, including, say, refugees and asylum seekers, you really, really do have to adapt how you kind of pitch your interventions or even how you offer your support in order to make it accessible for people. We basically, I think, also need to move away from a position where we're kind of sat in rooms just waiting for people to come to us, because there are so many hurdles to cross before somebody gets to sit in front of someone like me. And I'm very, very aware of that, which is, I know from our previous conversations, which is why I think we really struck a bit of a chord in terms of getting out into the community to invite people in to spaces like the ones that I offer. I think that's so important. We could definitely do better on that.
Oh gosh, yeah, I completely agree. I think therapy is seen as slightly like an elusive career sometimes for people. I think it's like an elusive thing to access to. So I definitely agree that we need to make it more accessible, and especially with like the work I do at Keep Real, it's just about bringing those people in. How do you look after yourself as well? I think that's what we'd love to know as a therapist. How do you look after yourself?
I think working with integrity means actually practicing what you preach. So I do use a lot of the techniques and advice that I will give my clients. So I am very, very aware that mental health is a full body experience. So for me, that means I'm looking after my mind, I'm looking after my body. Those two things need to have a positive relationship. So I definitely get up and move as much as I can. I'm into sort of like my exercise, even if it's just a walk, because I think physically occupying a different space can really change your mood. Also, I work online now exclusively because face-to-face contact isn't safe. So again, practicing what I preach in terms of clients, it's okay to let your eyes look outside of the screen. That's okay. I try not to kind of sit in front of my screen for too long generally. Getting up and moving around in between appointments is really important. I talk a lot with clients about establishing a really good baseline for yourself, and I apply that to myself as well. Like, is my sleep okay? Am I spending too much time on my phone? Have I had any social interactions? Because humans are really good at co-regulating each other, and that's part of our experience. So, have I seen another human being in the last hour or so? Is really important. Am I eating okay? You know, all the kind of stuff that you'd expect, but I think actually makes a very significant difference.
Yeah, it's just about being reflective. I think, and we've had so much more. We feel like we've had so much more time to do that now. I think it's just reflect on our behaviours, decisions. Sometimes it can be a little bit much, I think, for a lot of people, too much time to reflect. So, what would you say to those people that are finding it a little bit hard, where they're being quite reflective and finding it might be bringing some things up for them?
Yeah, when I think of reflection, I think about like, what's your inner experience? You know, what's it like to be in your relationship with yourself? And that's really important. I think it is also about finding a bit of a balance between that and what's your sort of external experience, like what's your contact with other people, what's your contact with the outside world. And I also actually want to be really explicit that I think it is a very important time to reflect, like right now, not just because of the pandemic, but also because of the racial justice movements that are going on all over the world. This is a really, really important time. So I know people are doing that work, myself included, because it's a really pivotal moment in our history. And at the same time, I think a part of what you're asking is, you know, where can we kind of healthily maybe step back from that so we can maybe return to it without being depleted? I think that's really important. So I guess similar principles, just being very, very mindful and setting boundaries around how much time you spend kind of engaging in the work side of stuff, whether it's kind of like your paid work or volunteer work or all the work of unlearning racism right now, for example. Looking at the news, because obviously we need to keep updated on the pandemic, you know, making sure people are okay. I think having a good balance between setting time for that, but also really setting time for other things, so you're not kind of depleted in any sense, or you feel really guilty that you're not doing any sort of work that you want to be doing that's important to you.
Yeah, it's just about that healthy reflection. It's just about taking a step back and going your own pace. And I think sometimes we forget to do that. Is our pace, what we have personally, might not work for other people. So I just think it's that. And sometimes with so much going on, it can just be a little bit like, oh, I don't know where to focus first. So it is, it's literally about taking a step back and thinking, okay, am I seeing enough people? Am I eating right? And just fitting activism within that as well, I think.
Yeah, and I think especially because activism, yes, that's something you can do as a sort of daily practice, like for yourself, but also it's a collective push.
Yeah.
So I think being open to negotiating and being open and honest and transparent with anyone that you find within your sort of activist circle, or even if you're not an activist, just anyone within your community and your personal world is really important. And maybe just even being explicit with, you know, I promise I will be honest with you when I'm feeling depleted. This is what I need when I feel depleted. That can be saying, I need some space, I'll come back to you when I'm ready, or I might go quiet for a bit, it's okay if you contact me. But then I think also reversing that and encouraging a conversation within your little community of, okay, well, what do you need when you feel depleted? Do you want me to leave you alone? Can I send you a text to see if you're okay? It's that real kind of negotiation and back and forth. Yeah. So it's kind of a I really want people to sort of not feel like it's an all or nothing thing, especially if you've got a pull towards sort of being an activist and you know, yeah, doing that kind of work. It's okay to just say, I need to step back for a bit so I can replenish my resources and then come back 100 miles an hour, because that's when I do my best work. And just being open with people about that and making that also a part of the dialogue that you have with everybody so you can do that work together, I think is really key.
Yeah, it's just negotiation, reflection, taking mm-hmm. a step back. I think it's just so important, and I think especially in the digital world, I feel like we forget to do quite a lot of things. We get immersed so quickly that actually mm-hmm. we need to kind of look at our space and see, oh, like, I need to take a step back and be reflective in my own way, and not just signing petitions online and donating and things like that, but actually doing the real work, but also, you know, taking time for yourself. So where do you see mental health problems shifting in the future as we ease out of lockdown? Mm-hmm. Do you think it will be an issue when we ease up, maybe?
Yeah, I think the lockdown has really made more visible a lot of things we already know, which is that a lot of people are isolated anyway. I can't tell you the number of articles and Instagram posts that I've read from people who have a disability that are saying, yeah, you know, this is, you know, all of this kind of being isolated is not new to me. And I'm really glad that people have been quite vocal about that, because it shows how society is unfortunately set up to kind of discriminate, disempower lots of different groups of people. We also know, unfortunately, that rates of domestic violence have skyrocketed worldwide, and that's purely because perpetrators have 24/7 access to survivors, and, you know, things like that. So, like I say, it's unfortunately shown us a lot of what we know already. So I expect the demand for mental health services to sort of be higher than ever, really. One silver lining is that we now know that we can do more work online, we can do more work remotely, and that's not only helpful in terms of, you know, God forbid if there's more disruption to social contact because of the virus, because we don't know how that's going to go, but also just make services more accessible. And I remember, you know, earlier in our conversation where you said, you know, sometimes people ring a helpline first. I think it's really good to have lots of different options for people to engage with services, because it's such a big, scary, anxiety provoking thing most of the time. So if somebody needs a bit of a taster, you know, for talking to someone or reaching out, if sending a text on the, you know, on their first try is going to feel good for them, then awesome. You know, maybe that's just what they need and that's that. But for other people, they might seek different types of support. I expect the impact of this is obviously going to go on for such a long time for so many different reasons.
Yeah, and I think it's been great to see mental health organisations step up and mm-hmm. and know that actually there are huge gaps. It's magnified the inequalities month by month. I mean, I've been keeping up to date with Dr. Daisy Fancott's COVID-19 social study. So she's been doing it's really good. You need to check it out. Cool. So she's got about, I think it's about 90,000 participants. I may be lying.
That's incredible.
I know it's about 80 to 90,000 participants around the UK taking part in this survey. And it's showing the trends of week by week of anxiety and depression levels, disparities between the BAME community, white people, lots of mixtures of people with disabilities, learning difficulties, things like that. And it's been quite interesting to see the kind of life satisfaction levels like dip and come back up again, but for people that are already struggling, it's remained the lowest in life satisfaction, but the highest in depression and anxiety. It's been quite difficult to read, but also it's very eye-opening, so I'm glad that studies like that have existed and continue to research what is happening in lockdown. I think we've still got work to do. So what are the positive things you have been seeing throughout lockdown? If you have anything at all, it doesn't have to be mental health related.
I would say it's been interesting to me as somebody that works with trauma quite a lot to really view what's going on, from that lens, because we're all collectively in a survival process. I am always honestly very, very moved by all the different ways that each of my clients who've experienced something traumatic find a way. Obviously, sometimes that is adapting in not very healthy ways, but you know, it's completely normal and completely understandable that if you've been through something traumatic, then the world doesn't feel very safe. You know, you within your body or your mind doesn't feel very safe anymore. So people can really struggle with finding kind of safety and comfort and trust in all of those domains. So people find a way however they can, even if it's, you know, drugs, alcohol, you know, or just staying a bit more isolated. Like, I think we can be compassionate about why people fall into that place if they've experienced something traumatic. Equally, a little bit of what we've just described is true, which is that people are finding a way to connect with each other. People are finding a way to support each other. People are finding a way to really adapt through this time. So I think that's one of the silver linings in a way is the human capability to adapt, even at times of, you know, we don't have a blueprint for surviving pandemics.
Very true. From the film Contagion, which is terrifying to rewatch in lockdown.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that's part of, not to kind of be all fluffy about it, but I think it's remarkable what we've been able to do, and people wanting to really help each other has come out, I guess, just as much as unfortunately all the terrible things as well. So I'm really I'm happy to see that in some way.
Yeah, it's been wonderful to see it, especially where I live. I think I don't really talk to my neighbours that much, mm-hmm. only like next door. And we had at the beginning of lockdown, we had a slip of paper with everyone's names and numbers and email addresses on, saying, hey, if you need food or if you need anything at all, just, you know, there's people out there. And I think it's given that permission for people to bridge those gaps in their own communities, mm-hmm. going, oh, okay, like, I'm not alone in this. This is like a... Like I keep saying in different talks and on Twitter of all places, is that we're all floating on the same sea in a different boat. We're all experiencing things slightly differently. And it's just been great to see people adapt. And I've been seeing some really cool things from I think it's Arts Council funded, and it's by, I think, the Twitter. It's called Hospital Rooms, and it's about bringing like art therapy practice into like in quite a therapeutic way, in like Zoom, big Zooms every week. So it's about bringing things that people have never experienced or would like to experience therapeutically, and bringing that into a visual world where they feel safe in their own spaces. So it's been absolutely amazing to see people adapt, maybe not in some of the best ways, but in ways that is comfortable for them and that they feel comfortable in their own experiences as much as they're able to.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's especially important because one thing that I've been thinking a lot for myself, but also one thing I've talked a lot with my clients in terms of working with them in lockdown, is that experience of like constantly meeting yourself. And that what I mean by that is a bit of, you know, partly because we've all been in lockdown, so you're very limited in who else you can meet. But I think it's absolutely normal at this time to really experience kind of your good days as really good days, and your like your rubbish days as really rubbish days, and they can seem more pronounced. But that's kind of because you're such in this acute phase of survival, firstly, and secondly, because you don't have all the other stuff going on that you normally do. So I really do want to reassure anybody listening that that is definitely normal, and, you know, might give your experience of sitting on your own and reflecting a very particular flavour. It's not always an enjoyable experience, unfortunately.
Very true. Oh, it's been lovely chatting. Oh my gosh, I could just talk for days. And I think, especially when mental health and lockdown and those experiences have kind of shaped us and in where we're going now, it's if anyone could wave a magic wand, this is a good question. I hope it is. If anyone could wave a magic wand, what would you want to change the most when it comes to people accessing services for mental health?
I would like to see more creative ways to provide psychotherapeutic support, because a lot of the stuff that I offer is kind of easily digestible and easily translatable to lots of different formats. that people could engage with or find interesting or find helpful. I wish I was more educated on deconstructing sort of capitalism, but I'm not. However, I think ring-fenced funding for services is absolutely essential, and we just haven't had that. Because, for example, I forget exactly how much money it is, but the government a couple of weeks ago, in response to the increased rates of domestic violence, promised like a substantial amount to be sort of disseminated to services. But on the ground, that doesn't actually translate to that much if you're thinking about disseminating that nationwide. And that is often how a lot of charities and services struggle for survival in themselves, whilst also providing services to people who are in survival mode anyway. So it's in some ways you've got to be really careful of not becoming traumatized from doing the work, as a practitioner. Yeah. So magic wand would be, yeah, ring fence funding for sure, and more creativity. If we could get that, that'd be awesome. If you could arrange that, that'd be
yeah
great.
I mean, yes. I would absolutely love that. I think I've been, like in previous conversations, about campaigning for better mental health in a more creative way. And I think that that is something that is, it's happening. There's a lot of people doing very yeah. similar things to what I do. But again, it's that, it's the funding, and the arts anyway doesn't receive as much funding as it should, yes, arguably. Yeah. And mental health definitely is so underfunded as well. And I think because there's such a broad spectrum when you say the arts and mental health, uh-huh. sometimes those funding pots can be a little bit too vague and things go missing, and funding, it needs to change. I mean, yeah. it's quite an old school method where you have to fill out like application forms and pitches, mm-hmm. And it can be very competitive, which then puts things into numbers, and we're forgetting that people are, you know, mm-hmm. are affected by the outcomes. So yeah, I think, oh God, we've got so much to change. We're going to change the world. Things are already changing. people, I think, are more inspired to feel like that they, well, I don't want to say the word, I want to say the word empowered, but I think people feel that they can bring about change more so, I think, throughout the last few months than before. Yeah. I hope so.
Yeah,
and so I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, and I think the way that you do things, and we've obviously talked about this, in terms of like bringing mental health as part of everyday language and just within communities anyway, because whilst you were speaking, I was thinking, I don't really understand why kind of mental health services are so kind of inaccessible and so formalised, because everyone's got mental health to look after. Yeah. I really don't understand why it takes getting to a point where you're really struggling or you're even in crisis where it's apparently okay to ask for help. You can ask for help anytime you want. And there's lots of different ways that people look after their mental health that can be informal or maybe more formal if they're seeing someone like me, you know?
Yeah, I think we just need to see that flexibility more. I think out of all the years, especially when we've spoken before, but doing my degree in counselling, and it seems like, yes, go for training, but then it's quite murky waters to become a therapist mm-hmm. for a lot of people. It's a lot of money. It yes. puts a lot of people off. And even I was looking earlier, I was like, oh, yeah, should I really go and do my master's in art psychotherapy? And mm-hmm. I had a look at some of the courses, and I need about 10 yep. grand additional, which isn't something I definitely can't do. And part-time is... it's about, is it 4 years?
Yeah.
I can't remember, something like mm-hmm. that. And better than anyone, it is a long process.
Yeah, well, I trained for 6 years part-time, so I get it.
yeah. What was that like for you? I know we spoke about it before, but
tell me the journey. The process of training?
Yeah, and the 6 years of training for you.
I'm glad I did a longer training, because by the time I got to the end of it, I had a lot of experience. And my concern with a lot of the shorter courses at the moment that are being offered for sort of counsellors, psychotherapy trainings tend to be longer, but sort of short-term counselling courses that just sort of whiz you through a course, and then it's like, okay, you don't even have enough experience to be kind of like registered, let alone be employable or feel confident enough to do the work.
Yeah.
It's not the best setup, I don't think. And Yeah, it's a psychotherapy training is, excuse me, one of those things where you really don't know what you're letting yourself in for, because I think we've all got motivations to go into it because, you know, we're interested in people, we care about people. Yeah. I know for myself that, I mean, I wouldn't be doing any other job. And if I was, it would still be kind of people facing support, some sort of care role, because that's what I orientate towards and that's what my skills are. But it is definitely as much a personal process as it is as a professional one, because you have to really know yourself inside and out and back to front and upside down.
Is scary for a lot of people. I mean, even back when I did my degree, we had the one-way mirrored rooms for the sessions. Okay. And you'd record with a student and have a counselling session, and then there'd be a therapist behind the mirror watching your session, and then you'd have to reflect back on your session and it'd all be filmed and recorded.
Wow.
And it was awful, because obviously a lot of people always say, oh, I hate hearing myself back on audio. I hate it.
Yeah.
But even seeing yourself and knowing your own mannerisms, the way that you shift,
for sure.
The way that you talk it can be really difficult to do. So it's admirable to go through that process of 6 years counselling someone, but also finding out so much about yourself and knowing your own barriers, limitations, amazingness as a human being. Irene, it's been lovely to have you on the pod. So where can we find your work? How can we contact you?
Yes. So my private practice is called Therapy Leeds. So that's therapy-leeds.co.uk. And I'm also on Instagram, which is also Therapy Leeds. All of my, obviously, contact details are on there. I am a writer and a speaker, as well as being a psychotherapist. I offer consultancy to other practitioners who need kind of support on, say, opening their own private practice or working with certain types of clients. So all of those details are available online. And if anybody wants to reach out, say hello, ask for help, collaborate, do get in touch with me.
Amazing. Thank you very much.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Oh, no, it's been lovely. Oh, I've loved chatting. I think it always encourages me that people are just doing amazing things that are, well, integrative, but also just being a lovely, genuine person that just wants to change the way things are being done. And you're doing that. And it's lovely.
I appreciate that.
Thank you so much for listening, folks. Do check out Keep Real UK on all our social media platforms, where you can find all the work we do supporting better mental health in the community. And don't forget to check out all our other episodes too, which you can find on soundrebel.co.uk.